Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
And welcome to Still Watching 9 Perfect Strangers. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
If you are just joining us for the first time ever, I shall let you know this is not our usual format. What Richard and I usually do is pick a show, watch it week to week, discuss it, get really in depth with it. What we're doing here at the tail end of the summer before we wait for our next big show to start is just hit a few highlights of things that are going on. Something I realized, Richard, is that there's a key element that's missing when we do these sort of highlight episodes. There's a key element of it, the whole process that's missing for me. It's going to sound like I'm kissing up to our listeners, but honestly, it's like the lack of listener email and feedback, because I feel like they're so good at prompting great discussion. You know what I mean? Like, I miss it when we do these one-offs.
Yeah, no, I agree. They're also really good at theorizing and noticing little things that I don't pick up on and all that. So I miss the kind of sense that we're having at least some kind of virtual conversation.
Yeah, a larger conversation. And I just, like, it helped me realize how much those emails make me a better watcher as well. So we miss you guys. We will be back next week at the beginning of our next sort of big show, which is American Crime Story : Impeachment. You know, we will have a preview episode for you next week. Katie Rich will be joining us. The great Katie Rich will also have interviews galore for that one. So, you know, get back on the old emails, dust off your memory of what it was like at the end of the 90s for you. Or if you weren't born yet, tell us that as well.
If you weren't born yet, do not email us. Do not ever acknowledge your youth. I don't want to hear about it.
But stillwatchingpod@gmail.com is where you can reach us for that. We want to do this because we've done, like, you know, the other Nicole Kidman big lead sort of mystery prestige shows, Big Little Lies, The Undoing. This is another, of course, Liane Moriarty book. She wrote Big Little Lies. And so we wanted to sort of dig into a little bit. There's a lot of people in this cast also that are huge personal favorites of Richard and myself. And so we wanted to just sort of check in. This is going to, quote unquote, spoil up through episode 4, which I think is a good place to check in because it sort of reveals a premise that we couldn't really have talked about in the first 3 episodes. The first 3 episodes dropped as kind of a binge. Episode 4 is the first of the week-to-week model that they will be approaching from here out. So let us premise the story a little bit. This is a story of several people who are having a tough time in their life, who go to a very prestigious, very, very, very expensive, very, very hard to get into wellness retreat
called the White Lotus.
Run by a woman named Masha, played by Nicole Kidman. And she's got a couple staff members, but we focus on Masha, her small staff, and these 9 perfect strangers. And yes, there's, of course, a lot of DNA overlap with The White Lotus, which just made a huge splash on HBO, because I'm always thinking about the TV show Lost. I, of course, think about the TV show Lost, but also, like, another thing to think about is Survivor, which is in the DNA of both White Lotus and Lost, is something that we should all think about when we think about disparate personalities put into a pressure cooker situation, sort of like Big Brother plus Survivor is what this is. Do you feel like that, like, especially since the premise is this wellness guru has handpicked these individuals as the perfect blend of what she wants to sort of tinker around with, doesn't it? I mean, it gave me reality show vibes. How does it feel to you?
Yeah, reality show vibes for sure. Definitely, I see the Lost in there. You know, it's a kind of contemporary tweak almost on like on a desert island narrative or like a Westing game or Agatha Christie kind of thing. Like, it's not that everyone has connections to one another that they don't know about, but like there is a grander purpose for why they're there that they kind of aren't aware of in the beginning. And I suppose that could be similar to like surprises on Survivor, you know, like turns out, you know, you're actually in different tribes than you thought, you know, whatever, like twists, I guess. Yeah.
So we should say in the cast of the show, we've got a lot of great, fantastic folks, Melissa McCarthy, Bobby Cannavale, Michael Shannon, Regina Hall, Samara Weaving. Are there any particular standouts for you in this mix?
Well, I think everyone's pretty good. You know, it's fun to see Luke Evans kind of out of the, I don't know, action movie, you know, historic or like epic kind of stuff that he's done in film a lot. You know, so I like seeing him in that. Melvin Gregg, who plays Ben on the show, he was really good on season 2 of American Vandal. I don't know if you've ever watched that Netflix show that was a fake documentary. That was kind of brilliant. The second season less so than the first, but Melvin Gregg on the second season was really great. So it's cool to see him, and it's also really fun to see Manny Jacinto out of the good place and into this very bad place.
Yeah, looking just very zen and
no great. Worse for the wear.
So for me, and I talked, I should say we have an interview this week with director Jonathan Levine, who directed all the episodes. Something that he said to me in his interview was that he was like, I can say this now that people have watched episode 4, that this is a psychedelic soap opera. I kind of liked thinking of it in that way. So the thing that is confirmed in episode 4 that you might have grokked by what happens in episode 3 is that Masha is microdosing her guests with psilocybin mushrooms. And so some of their cathartic emotional journeys are aided by illicit substances. And this is her attempt to sort of have a breakthrough in wellness that might gain her notoriety. Does she also care about their well-being? That's a question that you might want to hold on to for the rest of the series. But you know, I don't think you can deny that these people are at least making some movement on some emotional issues that they had kept buried.
Yeah, and I think that, like, you know, it is a soap opera in some ways, but I think whatever character archetypes anyone fills, they don't fill it completely because, they even Masha, who seems to be this kind of nefarious person with a shadowy past, is humanized, you know? I mean, I think it's similar to The White Lotus in that way, where it's like, there is actual genuine pathos here. It's not that, like, some person is just irredeemably awful or broken or whatever. I appreciate that the show, in all of its kind of soapy trappings, still has that nuance.
And that's the point of one of these stories, is to take archetypes, put them in a pressure cooker, and then dig into the actual human, the things that they have in common underneath their veneer of whatever it is that feels like that makes them strangers, right? There's a few interesting pairings that sort of come out of this. A pairing that I really like is Grace Van Patten plays the daughter of the Marconi family, Zoe, and she has this like connection with Luke Evans's character, Lars. And that's one of those unlikely pairing moments that I find really fun to think about in something like this. Like, what would put these two people together? And I enjoy watching them find common ground. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because they're both sort of observing this whole thing from a more considered distance than some of the other people, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we kind of find out more about that considered distance in terms of Lars's character. And also there are reveals about everyone, but Zoe, you know, her sort of position in this world gets fleshed out more. And yeah, I think that they're an interesting actor pairing and a certainly a character pairing. I think it's also, I mean, this felt more inevitable, but it was still nice to watch. It's still been nice to watch, rather. You know, Francis and Tony, mm-hmm. who start the show hating each other, kind of realizing, like you were saying, that they do have some commonality, and it's kind of drawing them together, which I'm sure was part of Masha's evil, quote, plan. I don't know if it's actually evil.
Evil, maybe beneficial plan. Yeah, it's funny. Yeah. Their encounter, which is like the side of the road screaming match, right, is like, it's all, oh, you know, like I appreciate that Jonathan called it a psychedelic soap opera, because that is like almost out of classic Hallmark movie tropes, right? Like the city gal and the roughneck guy or whatever, even though he's a celebrity in his own right, right? I love this dynamic. Something that Jonathan pointed out is that Melissa and Bobby are like old friends that have worked together a number of times, and so there's this like nice shorthand there. And I just really, I mean, like, it is kind of a classic you know, unlikely couple, will they, won't they romance running through the middle of this thing. And I really enjoy it. I think Melissa's great. And Bobby is especially, sort of blew me away. Like, we know that Bobby Cannavale is great. We've known that since The Station Agent. But like, I think, you know, and then occasionally he reminds us in a big way, like Boardwalk Empire was a big time to be reminded, like, yeah, this guy is great. But like, I don't think we always remember that he is one of our sort of greatest actors, I think, yeah. That he has this in him, you know?
Yeah, he's great. And it's funny you bring up the Hallmark thing, because I don't know if you read this in, I think it was THR, but the second season of Nine Perfect Strangers is going to be set in a town that forgot the meaning of Christmas. So, yeah.
Oh, no.
And like, I think one of the characters might be Santa Claus.
Wow, yeah. Hot Santa. Can't wait.
But I think that, I think the Hallmark thing is funny, because you're right that there is that kind of like, we don't like each other, but maybe we secretly do, you know, or we figure out we like each other over the course of things. Like, but because the show is Hulu and it's more grown up and it's, you know, it can kind of tweak that familiar formula in darker ways than we're used to seeing. And I think that, like, I kept expecting there to be like a murder or something, but the big reveal being like, oh no, you've all been sort of slightly tripping this for a lot of this time, felt a little bit anticlimactic at first, but it actually, though, it spins the show in a direction that, like, I think in a good way pushes it away from the recent glut of like murder mystery stuff we've had on TV.
There is, however, a mystery running through this that is actually additive to the show. It's not in the book. And I talked to Jonathan about this a little bit. Actually, like, I feel like I keep referencing this interview. Usually we leave this till the end, but so I don't keep spoiling my interview. Let's just go now to our interview with Jonathan Levine, and then you and I could talk about it after.
Sounds good.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness, really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
So I wanted to start by asking you, there are so many phenomenal performances in the show. It's hard for me to pick one, but the one throughout that sort of just kept knocking me back was Bobby Cannavale. And he is so good in this episode when he sort of like breaks down and confesses this great guilt that he carries from his past. And I was just wondering, like, when you cast Bobby for this role, you know, did you expect him to go this hard?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I did not know who you were going to pick because we have so many wonderful people.
It's true. It's true.
Yeah. When we cast Bobby, I mean, casting Bobby was, you know, I'd loved him for a very long time. And Melissa, of course, knew him and they'd worked together in, I mean, I think this is like their third thing that they've worked together in.
Right.
I guess the short answer is, did I know he was going to do something this good? Like, no, I actually didn't. Like, I was very impressed with even just when he showed up and the way he was sort of carrying himself, the way he looked. I'd asked him to put on a little weight. He was reluctant, but then COVID hit, so I think it just happened anyway. He, you know, I just, even his, like, when he was making costume choices and stuff, like when we were talking, you know, the hat he would wear, or when he would wear like a Planet Hollywood shirt, he seemed to have like a very kind of layered, textured, clever approach to this guy. You know, that day we filmed that scene. We basically filmed the scene you're talking about, where he confesses to Melissa. We filmed it. We had 2 days to film it because it was one of those things where we would kind of film it at magic hour, and our cinematographer, Yves Belanger, is only available light. So you basically wait for magic hour, and then you can sort of shoot nonstop for about 25-30 minutes. And you know, we didn't think we would get the scene in 30 minutes. So we kind of scheduled it over 2 days. It was like, you know, it not only was he able to sort of navigate the emotion of it and sort of deliver almost like this, like, on the waterfront kind of like monologue. It was like, he also, I gave them a chance to kind of play around a little bit, because since it was available light, we were able to use two cameras at the same time. And they sort of embellished the scene as well, and even with the words, like, they kind of made the words their own, and I think that really also helped ground the scene. But no, I was pretty blown away by Bobby just across the board, and his ability to nail the emotion and also just be funny. He's kind of amazing.
Yeah. And how did that existent relationship that he has with Melissa, when you direct two actors who have a friendship or an established working relationship, how does that impact, like, your job? Is it much easier? Does that ever get in the way? What is that like for you?
I mean, in this particular instance, it was easier. I think, you know, it could probably be harder depending on the personalities involved. These guys were just so game. And had such an easy rapport, and also really, when analyzing a scene, could really get to the heart of what was working, what wasn't working, and you know, could help improve any scene just based on their insight. So yeah, no, in this particular instance, it was easy. I think I was a little trepidatious because you're kind of just walking into a pre-existing social unit. So I think if they kind of had turned on me, it could have gone bad. But luckily, we all collaborated really beautifully together. And I think the other cool thing was, like, even though this is the third thing they've done together, the tone of what we were doing with them was completely different. It was more grounded. It was more romantic. It was more, certainly more dramatic. And I think they were having a really good time doing that. So basically just, you know, I was able to help navigate these two beautiful scene partners who kind of really knew what they were doing and knew what they wanted out of the scenes. And luckily, it was exactly kind of spot on for the tone we were going for.
You mentioned shooting with only available light, and, you know, it's somewhat self-explanatory, but just, you know, in case folks listening at home don't know what that means, can you sort of explain what it means and why you decided to go with that approach?
Yeah, I mean, we didn't shoot with available light all the time. I should clarify. We shot at every exterior was available light. And, you know, I think that basically that just means that, you know, you're not putting any big movie lights up. Mm-hmm. And it's nice for a couple of reasons. One, it just gives you a flexibility as a filmmaker. And two, I think it really, you know, we were in this beautiful, beautiful place, and just having the opportunity to sort of really capture, or just crudely, like organically, what the light was doing, I think was really nice to also kind of amplify the themes of the show, which is like you have these kind of, you know, people who are living in a modern world and they have been kind of transported to this very kind of natural setting. And I think for me, seeing the context of these characters in this natural setting and being able to use the natural setting in an organic way was really important as well. But plus, like, I think, you know, a lot of cinematographers, and this is perhaps a relic of shooting on film, but a lot of cinematographers do add lights to things, and it doesn't make it look better. It's one of those weird kind of contradictions. Is that the more light you add, usually the more it looks like a studio comedy or something like that. It starts to get flat, and like, we really wanted to have a sophisticated kind of artful look to it.
And so that, and you mentioned being able to use two cameras. So without the light, the rigging in the way, you're able to shoot both sides of a conversation at once. Is that what you're saying? Or just coverage from different angles?
Yeah, no, without, you know, big lights, you can sometimes shoot both characters at the same time, which is especially helpful when you have someone like Bobby and Melissa, who are such great improvisers. You don't have to like remember what joke someone made up on one side of the camera,
right?
So that when you turn around, you know what I mean. And yeah, that's actually like when, having done movies with Seth Rogen and stuff like that, it you know, and these brilliant improvisers, that is something that you really have to be mindful of, is when you turn around, you're like, okay, what joke was funny on that side? And you have like, you know, a list of 10 of them, but you never really capture the magic of someone actually in real time hearing the line and then perhaps improvising a line back. You know, that's very important to have two cameras when you're working with people who like to improvise, or especially people who are as good at it as Melissa.
So you mentioned the you know, this staggeringly beautiful location where you're filming and how impactful that is to the story. My understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that this was like a, you know, a COVID dictated shift to shoot where you ended up shooting. And from a production standpoint, when you decided to shift locations, you know, do you have to rescout? Like, what is your process in terms of folding in a new setting to a story that you had already planned maybe elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, so I will tell you the true story, and it is something that could only have happened in this exact moment of the universe, because basically we were meant to shoot in LA, and we were, let's say, about 5 weeks out, and then it was like that day where the NBA shut down and Tom Hanks got COVID, mm-hmm. You know, that sort of day. People were like, okay, I guess this is going to be a real serious
right.
Thing, and then we just, you know, we pulled the plug. We were about to build sets, and we were about, you know, we were going to kind of, it was hard finding this place in Los Angeles. It was really, really challenging, and so we were going to build a lot, and we found like a couple really nice like mansions, but it wasn't going to have the sort of idiosyncratic, unique beauty that we really craved. The sets were going to be beautiful. But it just was going to be sort of a hodgepodge of a lot of different locations. And then we sort of shut down for a little bit, and we were really hoping, you know, to get back up in LA, because we had already hired a lot of crew and there were a lot of jobs at stake. But it became clear, if we wanted to go on our timeline, that we were going to have to go somewhere else. And so right. We were probably the first or second production back up, because we decided, you know, we had producers who are Australian, famously Australian, Nicole Kidman and also my friend Bruna, who are both Australian, and Australia was looking like they were doing better with COVID than America. So, however, we, as the filmmaker, I was not able to fly to Australia and scout. There just wasn't the time for that, and nor was there sort of... it just logically did not make sense in that moment of time. Mm-hmm. So I basically said, we kind of sent someone on the ground to like all those places and a few different kind of locations where we could, there were a few different hotels where we could take over the whole hotel. And so I picked the location, and we found this beautiful place where we did ultimately end up shooting in Byron Bay. But I picked it from like FaceTimes and which is like, you know, when you're shooting somewhere for 100 days or whatever, 90 days, it's like a pretty big risk.
Yeah.
So I was basically terrified, but I was like, this show is not going to happen unless we kind of pull the trigger on this right now. So when I showed up there, like, I was pretty nervous. I was like, if I have messed this up, this is going to be disastrous. But luckily, when I saw it, it was even more beautiful than the fixtures. You know, it wasn't a show kind of born out of COVID, but it was a show that we knew we could execute during COVID because it was a small cast. There were not a lot of extras, and we could sort of create a little bubble. But we got very lucky being in Byron Bay as well, because they, I don't think, had more than like 2 COVID cases this whole time. So it was a combination of really bad decision making on my part to pick a location from picture and really good luck. I would not recommend it. Like, if you're an aspiring director listening to this conversation, I would not recommend picking a location only from pictures. I would say it's very good to go to the location. I mean, usually you would go to the location and, like, I would sit there for hours and hours and pour over, you know, this kind of, and make a rigorous decision. But this was like, it was like different times, you know?
Yeah.
I think now it's problem. Now production's going up. There's a little bit, people are a little bit more used to the framework of COVID and the limitations and our, but it was uncharted waters for us.
Yeah.
So I
mean, you picked well. It's absolutely, it's like one of the most gorgeous settings I've ever seen for anything. So good job, you.
Thank you. Yeah, we're very lucky.
I want to ask you, you know, there's this revelation for folks who don't know that it's coming. There's a revelation at the end of episode 3, the beginning of this episode, that there is psilocybin microdosing happening as part of this wellness program. And there can be some sort of tricky tropes that people fall into when they're trying to do sort of altered states acting. And I was wondering had your eye out for that, like what you didn't want and how you made sure that you sort of landed what you did want from your performers.
Yeah. I mean, I have had the opportunity to direct a lot of people pretending to be on drugs. So I think every single thing I've ever done has someone has at least one like Molly set piece or one like, so I'm like to consider myself like an expert in this one particular area of directing. I mean, and of course this is a different tone, and also this is something where we kind of just wanted the audience to think something was a little bit up. We didn't really want them to know exactly what was going on. We wanted to be a little bit ahead of the audience with this stuff. So yeah, I mean, it was kind of written into the words a lot. You know, David did such a beautiful job with these scripts. And so it was, you know, the performance sort of organically came from the settings and the words. I did not want anyone to be playing messed up. You know, I didn't want anyone to be, it's kind of deadly when you're really like playing people on drugs, because actually I think when you see people on drugs, it takes you a second to figure out whether they're on drugs.
Right.
It's not just like, oh my, you know, it's not just like someone, you know, like Reefer Madness or something like that, like someone just like freaking out. I think it's you know, there was subtle behavior. Everyone sort of landed their own sort of subtle behavior on the drugs. And for some people, for Michael, it was one thing. For Bobby, it was another. For Melissa, it was another. And you know, a lot of it can also be dictated in the edit. So I would have people try things at the beginning and end of a take, for example. And so I wouldn't have to use it if I didn't want to. Or, you know, sometimes their rhythms, you know, I would ask people to do things a little faster or a little more, you know, a little more druggy. And like, I would say a little more druggy, and then, you know, I would sort of just see what their interpretation was of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think luckily, even if they just delivered the words as intended, I think that was pretty much where we wanted to land, was like, is something up with these guys?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that it's tough. You really want to find sort of nuance and subtlety within there, and you don't want people to be playing messed up. Unless you're doing it for a joke, like in Long Shot when Charlize is on Molly and has to negotiate a hostage crisis.
How much? I'm a huge fan of your film work, and so I just don't know why it didn't occur to me why you were particularly well suited for this aspect of the show until right now. But how much? does your camera movement around something like that, like the way that you move the camera around your performances, how does that contribute?
Well, that's another thing, and that's something, especially in episode 3, that we were looking at was using not just camera movement, but composition and lens choice to start to indicate that something's getting a little more messed up. Mm-hmm. Like when the guys are sitting around the fire and the ladies are in the hot springs, we were doing things with camera and with focus that would just sort of show you that things are slightly off. We were using some Dutch angles. We were using a little bit of drifting in and out. And that was all meant to sort of indicate that something is not right here. That's another tool in the toolkit is just, you know, subtlety with camera, but also kind of shooting it in a way that you wouldn't if everyone was sober. We tried to have very shallow depth of field, which I guess means basically that only the things that are in only like the faces of the characters are sharp and in focus, and the background kind of goes very soft. We would do subtle things with sound design in order to give you that impression that something is not quite right here.
You've mentioned, you know, some of my favorite films as like some things that you were looking at in order to capture the precise tone that you're going for here, which is something, I don't know, the word I would use is unsettling, but like there's comedy, there's drama, there's a lot of stuff going on. You mentioned Parasite, Melancholia, The Lobster, Get Out, Picnic at Hanging Rock, all this stuff. And so I guess I'm just curious, when you're looking at these other films or whatever you're looking at, how exactly do you transplant that inspiration? Is it just something that seeps into what you're doing, or are you actively trying to insert certain shots, or what does that look like for you?
It is more like a subconscious thing. And I think, it especially when I'm doing something that's hard to place, like genre-wise. I mean, I guess genre-wise now I can sort of say that I see it as like kind of like a psychedelic soap opera a little bit. I think looking at all those things, no, I'm not like, I will pull skills from various movies, from various reference movies, and I'll put them up. Usually I'll put them up on my wall in my office when I'm directing. I didn't have an office on this one because of COVID, so I just kind of kept them in on my iPad. And no, it's not really like that overt a, like, you know, I want to steal this shot from here or this shot from here. I think I would talk to my cinematographer. I would talk to my production designer, and I would say, like, this is what I like about this element of this. Or I would say, you know, in this could be like this scene in, you know, Repulsion, for example, or Midsommar, which we did kind of get, borrow a little bit from their color palette and some of their composition. It's more just a feeling, you know. It's more you just wanted to kind of infuse the soul of the piece with a little bit of its DNA. It's not like I want to rip this thing off from here and this specific thing off from here. It's a little more mushy than that. I just wanted to get into the subconscious of all the collaborators who are creating the visual, you know, feel of the piece. It certainly really only applies to the visuals. I think with performance, I was really just trying to be in the moment with these actors and get them to imbue these characters with humanity, and that was just incredibly easy, you know, for when you have a cast like that. You know, a cast of people who are just so warm and likable and so technically skilled, it's really not that hard to capture the humanity of the people you're looking at. And also, I really wanted people to to empathize with the characters in spite of their kind of sometimes obnoxious and bad behavior. And that's so much that it's just casting and just casting, you know, amazing people who are also having to be really lovely people, which I did not know when I cast them.
You lucked out. Yeah, no. You've said a million wonderful gushing things about Nicole Kidman as a producer on this project. This is, if I'm not missing one, her second Leanne Moriarty adaptation, TV adaptation that she's worked on. So when you're working with her as a producer on this, like, Do you go to her at all as like a Leanne expert? Is she like, well, you know, when you're adapting this author's work, this is the sort of thing you want to go for? What kind of conversations did you have around that?
I don't think it was so much about that, because that was sort of all kind of ironed out in prep. You know, like once the scripts are written, once David writes the scripts, it's, you know, and I read the book, of course. Mm-hmm. But once David writes the scripts, those become for me the text. You know,
right.
Because he's taken liberties, made changes, done, you know, so that, and so I'm going off of that. So no, I mean, I think that there were, there are things I was conscious of in adapting David's work, you know, as a student of his work and as a collaborator of his. But no, I think it wasn't, we didn't talk about it in the sort of macro like that. We really talked about the characters and what they meant and what their journeys were, and more just stuff that used the actual text as a reference rather than thinking kind of globally about Leon's work. And I think that was wise, because it's like, you can't really, like, this is nothing like Big Little Lies, you know what I mean? So it's like,
true.
I don't think there's anything like instructive. I don't think there's anything instructive from Big Little Lies to bring to this. You know, I think for me, the only thing I wanted to do was make sure it didn't look like Big Little Lies or feel that much like Big Little Lies. I wanted it to be more like, you know, to me, this is much more kind of tonally pushed than that is. This is a much kind of more crazy combination of tones than that was. So I think that was for me the biggest kind of thing to navigate. And that was more, I don't think Nicole could really help me with that. That was more between me and myself. You know?
Yeah.
So we certainly talked about tone. We certainly talked about what, you know, what we wanted the viewer to get out of, you know, certain scenes and you know, when we wanted things to feel funnier, more grounded. You know, she's got a very kind of strong sense of tone, and we knew that we were taking some big tonal swings here. So we were both just kind of holding hands and being brave about it together.
I'm going to hold on to that descriptor of psychedelic soap opera. That's going to linger with me. It's a really good one. Speaking of the sort of adapting this book, and I have heard you say that, like, the script is your text. The book is not, like, the book is not your Bible. The script is your Bible. And this, I think you told at least one actor not to even read the book, just so that they could make sure that they were playing this version of the character that you're
I did say that, but I didn't, that was also, we had like 2 weeks to go, and I think if we had unlimited time, I would absolutely recommend reading the book. It's just, yeah, I told Tiffany, like, I think your character is pretty different in the show, and I just don't want you to get confused by reading the book, because I'd heard from some actors previously that they had been confused as to remembering what parts of their character were from the book and what parts were not. But I certainly recommend the book to everyone, including all actors in the show. The great book. I don't know how I would give you a link to it now.
I definitely didn't think you were anti-literacy or anti the book or anything like that. But I wanted to ask you about this, there's a significant difference. I don't think it's a spoiler to say that, like, some of this mystery element of, like, what's going on with Masha and who is harassing her, and there's this episode ends on this big moment that's additive to the script from the book. And I'm just wondering if in your conversations with David, like, something that I've heard from a lot of people who make TV these days is that they like adding a mystery element because it really encourages audience engagement week to week, of the audience, like, sort of playing detective and actively trying to figure out what's going on. So when you add this mystery element to this already bonkers, wild, amazing story, like, Is that the intention there, or what are you looking for in the mystery element?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, not to speak too much for David, but I think that the book is this, you know, beautiful piece that gets you really inside all the heads of these characters. And that's something that is very well suited to the literary form, right? You can access their internal monologues, you can access their feelings in a way that you really kind of can't, unless they're explicitly stating it, in the form of a limited series. And it's also not a very plotty book, right? It's not a very plotty right. book. They get there and they work through the problem. And so I think that that was a challenge in adapting it, you know? And I think that, audiences today, myself included, you do want some sort of story engine, even if it's just the illusion of a story engine, to keep you hooked and engaged. I mean, this show more than anything is, a piece of pop. It's a pop conception, I would say. And so we are very interested in keeping the audience hooked. We are very interested in keeping the audience engaged. And this stuff can be really, really fun, I think, you know, just mm-hmm. from watching The Undoing. Like, I found that incredibly fun to be playing that guessing game. So I think that adding that mystery and a few other things that we add that you'll see coming up, is designed to do just that. Is designed to give you enough to stay hooked in that way that you'll stick around for the characters' revelations and the humanity and the arcs of these characters, which to me is like the most compelling part of the show. But I also understand the role of the mystery and I really enjoy it as a viewer. So that's kind of what it's there for, is to give you more of a plot engine and plot propulsion to keep this thing moving forward, as we're also giving you these kind of character studies.
I love that. And then my last question for you, and thanks again for your time, I really appreciate it, but my last question for you is, did you have what if any were your preconceived notions about the wellness community going into this project? And how has working on this changed, and I can't help but think it must have changed, your ideas around that whole wellness community coming through it?
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting, because I think I am like a lot of the characters in the book, in that I'm both easily susceptible to like the idea that someone can help me, and I'm also very skeptical of it. So, But I'm also, so I understood where all these characters were coming from. You know, I empathize with where all these characters were coming from. I feel like they find themselves in a very particular situation that is not a situation I would find myself in. But I do think if I went to a retreat and someone was microdosing me with mushrooms, I would be intrigued. I would stick around. I think that it's so interesting. We weren't that interested in like critiquing it. You know, I think we're interested in sort of analyzing the need and the sadness and the trauma that would lead someone to this place.
Yeah.
And then you know, beyond that, I think I really just feel a lot of empathy. And yes, I think there's probably a lot of places to take advantage of people. And yes, I think there's something inherently preposterous about thinking or hoping you can change yourself in 10 days. Unfortunately, that's not really how it works. But I certainly understand the instinct to want to. And I don't think people are foolish for trying stuff. So I don't know that my thinking on it has evolved that much beyond like, I understand where it comes from. I understand why people want to do stuff like that. I mean, and look, it's not just like the wellness community. I mean, so many things in our lives right now are designed to sort of make us feel better, or make it, you know, I have 10 apps on my phone that are designed to make me a better person.
Same, working, same,
but,
yeah.
So it's like, you know, I just think it's, you know, look, we live in like a really scary kind of time right now.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that it's not just COVID. It's not just, you know, all the innumerable kind of things that are going on in the world. It's like we all have these phones and we're all addicted to these phones and we're all looking at Instagram and seeing people living lives that seem better than ours. And we're all, you know, it's just, I find it to be incredibly complicated and fascinating, but I will say that I think, I truly understand it. I truly understand the instinct and I don't know. I would hope that we could all kind of, come to the revelation that, like, if you want to be happier, if you want to live a healthier life, if you want to, that's hard work, and that's not something that you can find in an app or in a 10-day wellness program. But I certainly, you know, if someone was like, hey, you can go to this place and maybe they'll drink a smoothie and maybe there'll be some mushrooms in it, and maybe, you know, I'd be like, okay, cool. I will sign up, especially if it was exclusive, especially if it was like, you can't get in. I'd be like, I really want to get in.
I know. I mean, I got to say, all I want to do now is go to Byron Bay and drink fruit smoothies. The way you shoot the fruit is like pornographic. So yeah, like give me all the smoothies for sure. Well, thank you so much for the chat. I really appreciate it.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
Okay, so something that he said, like, this is actually a question I didn't expect him to answer as honestly as he did, but I was like, you know, was the mystery put in there for that sort of, you know, similar to a reason that Mike White puts a dead body in the beginning of The White Lotus, like this thing that it's hard nowadays to get prestige television made without, you know, a big mystery to hook the audience. So is it there to, like, keep them hooked? And he was just sort of like, yeah, not in like a really opportunistic way, but just sort of like, of course you want your audience like engaged and curious about your show. So if you drop a little mystery in there, what's going on with Masha, who's threatening her, that's a way to get people sort of talking week to week about what might be going on. Does that feel at all manipulative to you, or does that feel just perfectly fine?
It doesn't feel manipulative, but something that I mentioned in that review that bothered me about the series was that, like, it does feel like after four episodes that we should be out of the kind of introductory phase of the series, like halfway through these eight episodes. And I kind of still feel like it's been a lot of preamble, you know, and to get the fourth episode kind of clarifying the circumstances in a way that we can then move forward, that arrival feels a little bit late. And I do kind of wonder, and I think you and I have talked about this maybe on Little Gold Men or other podcasts, but about like the Netflix problem of like, well, we need to stretch it to 13 episodes for, I don't know, algorithmic reasons or something. And I feel like that can work well for storytelling, but sometimes it feels detrimental. And I kind of almost wondered, like, if they had been limited, if Nine Perfect Strangers had been limited to six episodes, let's say, so 6 hour story versus an 8 hour one, like maybe some of that storytelling in the earlier episodes would have been a bit more efficient.
The other thing that's interesting about that, though, is this ties back into a conversation we had over on Little Gold Men about the Ted Lasso conversation that people are having about season two. Something I found out this morning that I didn't know is that the first three episodes of Ted Lasso, when they wrote them, they thought they were going to be dropped at once in a binge. Because there is this hybrid binge week to week that people are experimenting with. That's what's going on with Nine Perfect Strangers. That's what happened with the flight attendant. You know, like, get people hooked with a little mini binge and then draw them out week to week. That's not what happened to Ted Lasso. Those episodes unspooled week to week. And I have to wonder if maybe you know, if people had seen all those episodes, those first three episodes at once, they wouldn't have some of the questions that they have about Ted Lasso season two. And similarly, those three episodes, first three episodes of Night Perfect Strangers were dropped in a binge. So maybe they were written with the idea that like someone's just going to sit down and power through these and then they won't, it won't feel like it's drawn out if someone watches it all at once. Do you know what right. I mean?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah. I think if you were doing the first chunk of this series, you know, every Tuesday night or whatever, like that, it could get even, you know, that would be pretty, I think, frustrating. But yeah, I guess arriving at the end of episode three where, God, I forget the character played by Asher Keddie, who is kind of the lone Australian.
Heather,
In this Australian production. well, at least shot in Australia. She, you know, the episode ending with Heather being like, are you drugging us? Which is a great moment. And it's like, it kind of, zooms in on her face and then kind of pulls back across the table as they all turn to look at Masha, you know. If you're going to watch those three episodes in a binge or like when it's all available on Hulu, which I guess a lot of people did, that is a satisfying ending. But I think I watched it more piecemeal because I had screeners.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's worth talking about this show. There's only been four episodes so far, but the show hasn't landed with like as big of a splash as some of the other similar shows. However, I was talking about this in a meeting we just had, but like the thing to remember about something like White Lotus or even The Undoing is that I feel like people didn't really get caught up. And even Mare, you know, Mare happened a little earlier, but those shows that people get kind of obsessive about, usually they wait a little bit and then get obsessed in the last 2 to 3 weeks. That's the pattern that I've been seeing anyway.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I think that like that is a viewing pattern that we, I mean, you can't really get used to something that's that kind of erratic and unpredictable, but like at least we can expect the unexpected in terms of like when people are watching things. And I think, you know, a small fraction of people in this country and around the world are actually on Twitter. But I know that like Twitter and other media coverage of shows is pervasive enough that like you see people being like, all right, fine, I'll watch it, you know, and then they catch up with White Lotus right. or whatever. And then they like it. And then they're there for the last two episodes or whatever, when everyone else is watching them. So that could happen with this. Yeah. And because it has such a big cast that like I feel like people will have to be drawn to it eventually.
Well, let's talk about I think someone that you especially like or someone I like, Regina Hall. I don't think it's a spoiler to say, basically we get like people have their one-on-one sessions with Masha and it's not like there are character centric episodes per se. It's not like, oh, this is the Heather episode and this is the, you know, whatever episode, the Zoe episode. But in those one-on-one sessions, we do get a little bit more of that sort of in treatment, deeper character work with a given character, and then usually after that there is some sort of like explosion. We do see a sort of explosion from Regina Hall in this episode in that sort of dummy exercise. She's playing this like bottled up nice woman who has a lot simmering underneath. Regina Hall is a performer we like. Well, what do you think of this marriage of performer and character?
I think it's fun. I mean, I think Regina Hall has been so good in such varied things, you know. Done great television work. She's in the Scary movies, at least one of them. And then she was so good in Support the Girls, a film that came out a few years ago that mm-hmm. we at the New York Film Critics Circle gave her Best Actress for that, which I was very happy about. And so you see her in this role in the beginning, and it's fun seeing her as the sort of, not dowdy, but sort of like, oh, like, gee whiz, you know, kind of like innocent.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly who's a little bit frayed at her edges, you know. And then having that break into something much darker is, I think, a great arc to play and one that I haven't seen Regina Hall do. And I think also a lot of Black actors don't get to play that kind of like, you know, that sort of guileless, seemingly guileless, innocent sort of like, just I'm just a mom, you know, like that's such a kind of cliche of like Midwestern white womanhood or whatever. And so it's fun to see Regina Hall get the opportunity to play that character and then to have new dimensions of that character revealed as the episodes go.
It reminds me a lot of what Yvette Nicole Brown did on Community, like a similar sort of vibe to that, but with the potential to break out of it in an even bigger way than Yvette Nicole Brown occasionally got to do on that show. But yeah, I do. I think it's an interesting role for this character. It is interesting. I mean, I just think Regina Hall is so beautiful. So it is like, it is interesting to try to cast her in like a dowdy sort of space, but
like a wig can do a lot, but it can't do that much.
Is usually in a sort of author avatar of sorts, certainly like a main character we're rooting for. And if there is a main guest of the various guests we're watching here, it is Frances. I actually love this for Melissa. Totally, this show is trying to do something that is a little hard to wrap your arms around sometimes, right? Because there's like comedy and there's drama and there's all this sort of stuff. So it's an unpredictable and kind of unsettling vibe. And I think that's actually what they're going for. But like, it can be hard to sort of grok on. But what it means is that I think Melissa is in a really interesting space where she's like naturally funny. And she, according to Jonathan Levine, she, you know, improvised plenty. But like, there's this enormous sadness. And of course, we've seen Melissa do some great dramatic work. But I just think this is an interesting like blend for her. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think you and I both love her work in Can You Ever Forgive Me? The Marielle Heller film from a couple years ago that got her a lot of awards and an Oscar nomination, everything like that. And it was such a great marriage of her comic sensibilities and her other acting abilities, you know, and that kind of weariness, also a writer. So I think this is kind of a tweak on that, kind of amped up for the tone of the series. But she's really good at playing frustration, you know, and not frustration in like the kind of like, oh, I hate the world, everyone's an asshole, but kind of frustration with like in under her own skin. You know, she just seems so restless. And that's a quality that she's really good at tapping into, partly because she's such a good physical actor. And has been in so many things where she's doing either slapstick or even the way she kind of like shuffles her gait in Can You Ever Forgive Me? She's just really good at communicating presence, even when she's not speaking. I like when comedians like explore the sort of underside of their comedy, which it seems like McCarthy is doing in her better roles. You know, like the funny is still there, but there's that funny is coming from something. And I think she's tapping into that.
The last actor I want to like sort of take a tour through here is Michael Shannon. And something that I thought was really interesting is that he kept saying that he didn't think he was the right actor for the part. Apparently at one point he asked Jonathan Levine, should this be David Hyde Pierce? Like, why is it me and not David Hyde Pierce or whatever?
It is funny casting in the same way that Regina Hall's casting is, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, for him to play this sort of like, I don't want to say beta male, but, you know, like whatever you want to describe it, you know, definitely wears their cell phone on a clip on their belt kind of guy, and him being Michael Shannon. But again, I just think that for when he wilds out, I think his wilding out is, you know, is allows Shannon to like lean into all that weirdness that he's incredibly capable of. You know?
Yeah. And that weirdness, I think, also oftentimes reads as menace, you know, and even in something, in playing a character sort of seemingly as anodyne as this guy, you just sense that there's something about to break, or that there's something that, you know, there's a force that's being held at bay that's going to like come rushing out. And I think an interesting subversion that the show does in terms of this character is, I mean, I haven't watched past, I think, the fifth episode, so maybe something else is coming. But, like, it seems thus far that actually that menace that, like, you kind of innately detect in Michael Shannon, in this case, is actually grief and a helplessness about how to help his wife and his daughter, his surviving daughter, you know. And I think that's a really, again, with similar to the way that McCarthy's innate, you know, McCarthy-ness is being used in interesting ways in this show, I think that's true of Shannon. So I think that kind of casting against type actually is smart casting, because you're using, you know, the whole part of the Michael Shannon buffalo. All parts of the buffalo, I guess, is the term.
The Michael Shannon buffalo is my new band name. All right, so I mean, if you're to keep watching the show, Richard, which, you know, is obviously what the people who made it would want you to do, what would you want to see happen in the final episodes that would get you sort of even more excited about the show as it exists?
That is a good question. I think that I thus far am struggling for the why of it. Not the why are they there and why is Masha doing what she's doing, but why is this show happening? Like, what is trying to be, what are the grander conclusions? And maybe that's just because, you know, we just finished White Lotus, and I think that show had so much to say about this country and the world as it is, and, you know, while also telling a kind of, in, you know, a really engaging series of stories. And I think the stories are here in this case. You know, we have a lot of flashback, not to like actual like images of the past, but people talking about their past. So we're getting that sort of compelling, deeper narrative behind each character. But like, I think I'm just curious what the show is trying to say, if it's trying to say anything. You know what I mean? Because like, we've seen jokes about like wellness culture and all that before. So that the show isn't really pioneering any new territory in that regard. So I'm curious to see what's going to set it apart from everything else thematically.
I am also interested to hear. I have read the book, so I'm curious about this mystery element and if as it resolves, it will feel sort of organically connected to what the original story is trying to do there. And I think I'll say this. I'm always excited to see Nicole Kidman do a big performance, and she's doing like a big performance. There's a fun wig and a fun accent all together in the shaker here, in the smoothie of this performance. And it's a beautiful show in terms of like they shot it in Byron Bay and it's like completely gorgeous. And like, I want to exist in that geodesic sort of dome space that they have, stuff like that. And I do like these opportunities for these actors, but I am curious to see how it all sort of hangs together in the end. And I am curious to see if people get hooked in, because I think it is like sort of compulsively watchable in that way, that soap opera way that Levine mentioned, of just sort of who's going to lose it this week. Sort of interesting which actor gets to like pop off this week. So I think it's something that people could get really hooked on if it rises above you know, whatever else people have their heads buried in. So I'm interested to see how the rest of the series unfolds and if people get into it and if they land the plane.
Yeah, and I also think that like Ben and Jessica, the couple who's are having like sex problems, I think they haven't quite moved to the forefront yet, and I kind of am curious what they're doing there, you know.
I hope they do, you know, like I've seen a little further than you, but I still haven't seen like these two actors, both of whom we really like. Samara Weaving is like, I also think that the like what's interesting in the book is that that young woman in the book has sort of ravaged herself with plastic surgery. I think about Samara Weaving is like, that's just what Samara Weaving looks like. But they sort of styled her in such a way that I think the impact is the same. Not that she looks ravaged by plastic surgery, but just like, just down the rabbit hole of her own image. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I think they styled her incredibly. But that vulnerability, like when she approaches Frances and tells her that she just like loves her, you know, that like sweet romanticism that's in that character, I think is a really interesting juxtaposition. But yeah, I haven't seen them sort of have their major spotlight moment either. So I hope.
Especially because I can't think of a recent show or, you know, not even that recent show where like one of the characters sort of almost tragic arcs is that they won the lottery and hate the money. You know, I think that's really interesting. And
it's just Lost. That's it.
Oh, Christ, you're right.
No, but that's a long time ago. Yeah, so I think your point still stands. Yeah, yeah. But yeah.
If you're listening to this and weren't born when Lost came out, absolutely stop listening to this and never email us, by the way.
We get emails all the time on the show that I do about Lost. We get emails all the time from people who are like, so I was 11 when Lost came out. And I'm like, all right. So in summary, watch Lost, watch White Lotus, watch Nine Perfect Strangers. If you're feeling island FOMO, these are some good things to watch. And we'll see how it all wraps up. Richard, until we're back on the steps of the Capitol, back in 1998. For American Crime Story impeachment, where can folks find you?
Well, I'm gonna just be digging my own grave, like in a therapeutic way, just to see if it works. I'm curious. And while I once I'm down in that grave, staring up at the beautiful Australian/Californian sky, I will be tweeting at Rylaws and writing things at vf.com. Joanna, until we head to DC, where will you be?
I will be not slaughtering a goat, but maybe a Michael Shannon buffalo. You can also find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This, on vanityfair.com. And yeah, we'll be back with our berets on for American Crime Story impeachment next week. Bye.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines, stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ audio network like Last Days and TMZ Verified, available on all podcast platforms.